All right, just one more chapter. And this chapter is called The Chromosomal Basis of Inheritance. So we're, compared to other chapters, we're focused on what's happening at the chromosomal level. And starting out with this first slide, we're revisiting a cross that we looked at before. This is exactly the same cross involving the peas. What kind of cross is this?
Dihybrid.
Right. Why is it dihybrid?
Because we're mixing
together
two traits.
Correct? No, well, no. Two characteristics, which are color and texture of the peas. And the reason it's hybrid is why? Well, there always will be if it's a cross. Otherwise, you don't produce any offspring. But what specifically makes it a hybrid cross? Tracking two characteristics only explains the dye part of the word. What makes it a hybrid cross also? Well, what does hybrid mean? Just in everyday language.
It's like a mix of two things.
Right. So what kind of cross is a hybrid cross? So you're not ready for exam five is what you're saying? Well, in a hybrid cross, the parents differ in their traits for the characteristic being studied. Right? Remember the monohybrid cross that we started with flower color? That's only one characteristic. That's why it's monohybrid. But the two parents originally were purple and white. So they're different from each other in their traits for that one characteristic. That's what hybrid means. Similarly here, you have one parent that's green-peed and one parent that's yellow-peed. But at the same time, we're paying attention to the texture. So one parent is wrinkled-seeded and the other parent is round-seeded. None of that's new. That's all stuff that you should have known coming into this. What we're looking at, though, that is new is that we're paying attention to what the chromosomes are and what are on those chromosomes. All right, so in this specific case, you have a doubly homozygous dominant parent, meaning genotypically that it's upper, upper Y, upper, upper R, homozygous dominant with respect to color, and therefore yellow, and homozygous dominant with respect to texture, and therefore round, because yellow is dominant over green, and round is dominant over wrinkled. The other one is a doubly homozygous recessive parent, lower, lower Y, lower, lower R. That's all we really paid attention to. That's all we really had on the diagrams before. We didn't pay attention to anything about chromosomes. But, of course, chromosomes are the real things that these genes are part of. Right? A gene is simply part of the length of the DNA that's in the chromosome. It's just a subsequence within the overall sequence. And what do we call the positions that these genes are occupying? Also review. No one has an idea? The position of a gene on a chromosome is called what?
Locus.
It's locus. Right, the plural of which is loci. So the gene loci here are represented by the little black marks on the red or blue chromosomes that are shown here. Okay? Now, how many chromosomes are shown in each parent? Well, there's four chromosomes, but there's two types of chromosomes. Now, that's not to say that N equals 2 for peas. Peas have an N greater than 2. But we're only showing two types of chromosomes here, Because there are only two chromosomes that carry the two characteristics we're talking about. Each chromosome is a specific type of chromosome because that chromosome type carries those particular types of genes. Another type of chromosome carries a completely different set of genes corresponding to a completely different set of characteristics. So there are different chromosomes in the cells. We just don't care about them at all because we're focusing on exactly two characteristics. And one of these characteristics, pea color, has as its gene locus, resides on one of these two chromosome types that we're looking at. The other gene, which governs seed texture, is on a different chromosome compared to the color one. That's why we're paying attention to two chromosomes. If they were actually on the same chromosome, we would only pay attention to one chromosome here. But the point is, all the rest of the chromosomes have nothing to do with seed color or seed texture, so we're just not even paying attention to them. Okay, so the black marks are the gene loci. And notice that by each black mark, each locus, there is either an uppercase Y, a lowercase Y, an uppercase R, or a lowercase R. So the genotypes correspond to specific alleles on specific chromosomes in reality. We just haven't looked at the chromosomes before. But as we've said before, the first time we looked at this dihybrid cross, since each parent is doubly homozygous, in other words, true breeding for both of the characteristics, each parent can make only one kind of allele when all you care about is seed color and seed texture. Because meiosis is going to choose one or the other chromosome of each type. The chromosome that's carrying the color gene in this left parent are the two chromosomes that are carrying the color gene, because it's a diploid parent, of course. They're carrying two of the same allele. Both of them are uppercase Y. Therefore, when meiosis makes a gamete and randomly chooses one of those two chromosomes carrying a Y, it doesn't matter which one's chosen. Right? You're going to get an uppercase Y carrying chromosome, since that's all that parent has. It has two of them, but it doesn't matter which one you choose. And similarly, it doesn't matter which one carrying the R you choose in a true breeding parent. That's why only one gamete is shown for this parent. Obviously, all the gametes that that parent can make are genetically different when you consider all genes and all characteristics. But when you're restricting your attention to these two, this true breeding individual can make only that one kind of gamete. And the other one can make only one kind of gamete as well. Only a gamete that carries a recessive color allele on one chromosome and a recessive texture allele on the other chromosome. Okay, so the genotypes for the two gametes are upper Y, upper R, lower Y, lower R. Right? One parent can make only one kind of, each parent can make only one kind of gamete. And therefore, when you get the two gametes together, which is what the cross is, to produce a zygote, there's only one possible zygote when all you care about are these two characteristics. Every zygote has to be upper Y, lower Y, upper R, lower R. Right? That's all you have to work with. Well, we already knew that from the Punnett squares, but now we can see them on chromosomes. In other words, every one of the F1s that are produced is doubly heterozygous. Heterozygous with respect to pea color and heterozygous with respect to pea texture. But because each of these two characteristics is Mendelian, and therefore there is complete dominance of the dominant allele over the recessive allele, that means that every one of the F1s are doubly dominant. They're dominant color and dominant texture. Each heterozygous genotype, the color one and the texture one, means that phenotypically they're going to be fully dominant, right? So they're all yellow and round, just like one of the parents was. But they have different genotypes compared to the parents, because the F1s, being heterozygous, are not true breeding. All of that really is reviewed as well at this point. We get to these boxes, though, these two laws that are stated here. And these are laws that Mendel came up with, even though he really didn't understand molecularly what the explanation for these is. He had no idea what a chromosome is. But the two laws, as you see, are the so-called law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. Now, segregation, it, just as an everyday word, means what? Right, to separate and put in different places. So the law of segregation, as you see, says that the two alleles in a diploid organism, there are two alleles for any given character, for any given gene, they separate during gamete formation. Well, in a diploid organism, what produces gametes? What process?
Meiosis.
So the law of segregation describes part of meiosis, specifically the part of meiosis in which separation occurs. And what is that? What part of meiosis? Anaphase 1, exactly. All right, so this is, remember that in anaphase 1, that's when the ploidy gets reduced, importantly. But the reason it does is because one of those chromosomes carrying the one allele goes to what will be one cell, and the other chromosome carrying the other allele for that same gene is going to go to what will end up being a different cell. They're segregating. Well, they do that regardless of what the genotype is, so they do that for the original parents. It's just that it doesn't matter, because when you have two of the same and you separate them, you can't tell them apart, the two groups, right? Well, these are heterozygous individuals, the F1s. So it does matter which one the cell, the gamete, gets, whether it's the blue version or the red version. All right, but anyway, that's what the law of segregation refers to, specifically what happens in anaphase 1 of meiosis. Well, what is it that... Well, let me just go to the law of independent assortment. That obviously has to do with independent assortment, which we already discussed. What is independent assortment? What does it specifically refer to? That's right. It is. It refers to the fact that it doesn't matter. That's the independent part of the phrase. But first of all, when are we talking about here? What?
Metaphase.
More specifically.
One.
Metaphase 1 of meiosis is when independent assortment happens. And what did I say just the word assortment by itself refers to? No, I mean that's what the word means in everyday language, but not in meiosis. What happens in metaphase 1 of meiosis? Well, it's a metaphase, therefore something's lining up, just like all metaphases, right? Whether it's mitosis or meiosis.
Where the genes line up?
No, not genes. I mean genes are there.
The alleles for the gene.
That's not what's actually lining up, though. What is it that lines up during metaphase 1 of meiosis? Homologous pairs of chromosomes. Now, each chromosome is carrying thousands of genes, but it's not the individual genes that are lining up. It's chromosome, pairs of chromosomes. And what's another name for a homologous pair of chromosomes that are lining up?
Tetrads.
Tetrads. Right, that's what lines up during metaphase 1 of meiosis, tetrads. And assortment refers to how a tetrad, one pair of homologous chromosomes lines up, because there are two possibilities. Right? It's a homologous pair. They are homologous to each other, but not genetically identical, right? They have the same number and types of genes, but not the same version of genes necessarily. So they're homologous to each other, but not identical, and therefore there's two possibilities, which you can just represent randomly as the flip of a coin to determine whether that tetrad is going to line up red one way and blue the other, or blue one way and red the other. Those are the two possibilities. That's assortment by itself, how one tetrad lines up. Independent assortment refers to the fact that how one tetrad lines up is not at all affected by how other tetrads are simultaneously lining up. Which means, in effect, each tetrad flips its own coin, as opposed to the cell flipping one coin, determining for all tetrads simultaneously which way red's going to go and which way blue's going to go. All right, and that's why you can have what you have right here. Now, as I said before, there's more than two chromosomes here, but we're only paying attention to two. And if you have two chromosomes, and therefore two tetrads, two chromosome types, and therefore two tetrads lining up, then there's two possible ways that that can happen. Remember the 2 to the n minus 1 I told you about as a formula? Well, n is bigger than 2, but we're only paying attention to 2. So this special n is 2. And therefore, 2 to the n minus 1 is 2 to the 1, which is 2 overall. Two possibilities. One possibility is that they flip their coins in such a way, the two coins, in such a way that the reds are going to go together to one cell and the blues are going to go together to the other cell. The only other possibility is that they flip coins so that one of them gets a head and one of them gets a tail. Right? And each cell is therefore going to get one blue one and one red one. There's no other possibilities when you only consider those two chromosomes. But anyway, that's what independent assortment refers to. If you didn't have independent assortment, then you wouldn't have as much genetic variation in your gametes, because all the reds would go one way, all the blues would go another way every time. Instead, that's just one possibility. Okay, so that's why, in the end, that's just one reason why you have gametes that are different from each other. What are the other two reasons that sex gives you genetic variation, by the way? Independent assortment is just one of those three. What are the other two? No, I'm talking about why sex, as opposed to asexual reproduction, produces more genetic variation in offspring. Right, that's the third one to happen in when you order them, in the order in which they occur. What is the order of independent assortment? Is that first or second? It is second. So what is the first thing to happen that sex provides as an additional source of genetic variation? Crossing over. Right. Crossing over produces a hell of a lot of variation because of so many different ways that each chromosome can cross over. That already happened. It's not shown here, just for clarity. That's why you don't have any single chromosome that's partly red and partly blue, but in reality, of course, it does happen. And that happens before independent assortment. When does crossing over occur, specifically? Specifically, prophase 1, yes. Prophase 1 of meiosis. It doesn't make sense to talk about crossing over in prophase 2 because you no longer, by that point, have two homologs, right? The two homologs after meiosis 1 are now in totally different cells. They can't synapse anymore. They're in different cells. Synapsis occurs only in prophase 1, and that's when crossing over occurs. All right, let's go on to slide 2. We're looking at some close-ups of fruit fly eyes. And fruit flies belong to a genus called Drosophila. In case you see that word, that's what we're talking about. Fruit flies are used a lot in genetics experiments for various reasons, one of which is that they're really easy to maintain, that they don't die very easily in the lab, that they're easy to raise. And also, another reason is that it only takes about a week for a generation. So you can go through many generations in not all that much time compared to other species. Well, they're used for all kinds of different characteristics, but here we're sticking our attention to just eye color. And it's really more complicated than what we see in this example because there's many different eye colors, really, that are... And the reason it's more complex is that it involves more than just the gene we're looking at right now. But for simplicity, we're just looking at one gene that contributes to eye color, and there's two possibilities here, two traits. The red-eyed individuals are the so-called wild type. So those are the ones that you see most frequently in real populations in nature, or including in your house. If you leave bananas out too long and you start getting fruit flies, you can actually, just with the naked eye, tell that their eyes are red. Most of them are. Every once in a while you'll see a white-eyed individual, though. That's the mutant version. All right, so that's the characteristic and the two traits we're dealing with. In slide 3, let's look at the cross. Now this looks, for a lot of it, like it's just another version of the same things we've looked at, but it's not. All right. The reason it looks like it's just a monohybrid cross is because we're paying attention to just one characteristic, right? Eye color. And it's a hybrid because one parent is red-eyed and the other one is white-eyed. But what information is up there on that first line that we haven't cared about before? Right, the sex of the parents is listed here. We didn't list that before, for like flower color, for instance, because it did not matter at all. In other words, on the first one we looked at, the flower color one, it could have been that the female is the purple-flowered parent and the male is the white-flowered, or the other way around. The male could be the purple-flowered and the female could be the white-flowered. The results would be exactly the same numerically when you go through F1 and F2. And the reason that it would not matter in that case is that the flower color gene for peas is on an autosome. So who can remind us of what an autosome is? Anything other than a sex chromosome. Any chromosome other than a sex chromosome. That's right. So, for instance, in humans, humans is what we looked at for the karyotype, when we looked at a karyotype. There's 23 kinds of chromosomes in a human, but the first 22 of them, numbered 1 through 22, are autosomes, and then there's a pair of sex chromosomes, which is either XX or XY. All of the characteristics we've paid attention to up to this point have been autosomal characteristics, which correspond to autosomal genes. An autosomal gene is simply any gene whose locus is on an autosome somewhere. Doesn't matter which autosome. If it is an autosome, though, then that means both the males and the females have two of each of those if they're diploid, right? Two alleles for any autosomal gene. Well, that's not the case when the gene that you're interested in is not on an autosome, but it's on a sex chromosome instead. We call those genes, or those characteristics by correspondence, sex-linked genes. A sex-linked gene doesn't necessarily have anything to do with determination of sex. A sex-linked gene is simply called that because it's on a sex chromosome. The sex chromosomes get their name because they are, in one way or another, involved in determining sex of offspring. But that doesn't mean that every gene that they carry has anything to do with sex. All right? I'll talk more about that in a minute, but let's look at what we have here. We have a red-eyed female. This is the symbol for female. This is the symbol for male. A red-eyed female crossed with a white-eyed male. Well, this, like I said, it kind of looks like you're just the normal case, because just like for flower color, when you do that cross, 100% of the F1 has the dominant phenotype. Red is dominant over white. So this doesn't look any different, even though it is. Right? You then cross the F1s, and still in the F2 it kind of looks like it's the same. Because what was the result for flower color in the F2? Yes, it's a 3-to-1. What is 3-to-what? 3 of what to 1 of what? And more generally, or the general case, is 3 dominant phenotypes to 1 recessive phenotype in the F2, if it's a Mendelian characteristic, right? Well, it looks like that's what we have here, but it's actually different. We do have 3/4 of the overall offspring being red-eyed, which is dominant, and 1/4 of them being white-eyed, which is recessive. But it's not the same thing that happened in the pea plants. For flower color in pea plants, the 3-to-1 ratio means that 3/4 of all the offspring will be dominant and 1/4 will be recessive. But that also means 3/4 of all females will be dominant and 1/4 of all females will be recessive. Same thing for males. In other words, sex doesn't matter. That's not what we're getting here, though. Here we have in the F2, 100% of the females will be red-eyed. However many there are females, they'll all be red-eyed. Half of the males, however many there are, will be red-eyed, and half will be white-eyed. So sex does matter here, because the gene that controls eye color is not on an autosome, it's on a sex chromosome. The bottom half of the slide explains why this is true at the chromosomal level. I just told you what sex chromosomes are. They, in one way or another, for any given species, determine the sex of the offspring. But sex chromosomes, the two sex chromosomes, if there are, and not all species use sex chromosomes, but they also have differences that we'll talk about. But if there are two different sex chromosomes, like there are in us humans and also in fruit flies, we both use the XY system. So there's two different kinds of sex chromosomes, an X and a Y. They correspond to each other, and so we use the word homologous. But they're not truly homologous like the two number fours are, for instance, or any number, any chromosome type other than the sex chromosome. Those are truly homologous, meaning the two number fours are the same size, they have the same number of genes, the same types of genes, just not necessarily the same versions, the same alleles. All right, that's truly homologous. But when you have two sex chromosomes like an X and a Y, they're not truly homologous. One of them is bigger than the other. The X chromosome is much bigger than the Y chromosome. And therefore, there are many genes that are on the X chromosome, but not at all on the Y chromosome. Because that part, that corresponding part of the Y chromosome doesn't exist. It's much smaller than the X. All right? That's what makes the difference when we're talking about a sex-linked gene. We can see this here when we look at the chromosomes of these parents. So we're starting this crossover. These parents are the same as the original parents, but now we're looking at their chromosomes. In an XY system, what determines genetically a female is the presence of two X chromosomes. So a female genetically is an XX. She has two X chromosomes, and therefore this eye color gene, which is on the X chromosome but not on the Y chromosome, she has two alleles for that, just like for an autosome, right? There's two alleles for that gene because she has two of those chromosomes. All right, so she is really just the normal case that we've been talking about before. She specifically is homozygous dominant, red-eyed. By the way, they're using yet another different standard here for genotypes. We're used to using the initial for the dominant allele, right? Like P for purple, uppercase P for purple, and lowercase P for white. Here we're using the initial for the recessive allele, which is white. That's why it's a W. But if it's the red version instead, we put a superscript plus on it. So W plus really means red. W by itself means white. Don't be confused by that. Or try not to. So anyway, she's red-red for her genotype. W plus means both of her alleles are red. That's just another way of saying that she's true breeding, right? She's homozygous dominant, homozygous wild type. He, on the other hand, is a male genetically because he's X and Y. He has one X chromosome and one Y chromosome. The X chromosome that he has, of course, has an allele for eye color because that's where the eye color gene is. It's on the X chromosome. But there is no corresponding position on the Y chromosome because it's smaller. So that means he only has one overall eye color allele, whereas she has two. And that's why for a male, if we're talking about a sex-linked characteristic, which we are, and we're talking about a male, we don't use either the word homozygous or heterozygous. Neither one of those applies to a male, right? Homozygous means having two of the same allele. Well, if you only have one allele, that doesn't make any sense. And heterozygous means the two are different. Once again, you don't have two in a male. So instead of those words for a male, we use the word hemizygous. Hemi means half. The reason that makes sense is because compared to a female, a male has only one half of the alleles. He has one versus she has two. Now also, there is dominance here. There is complete dominance of red over white. But a male, being hemizygous, means he has only one allele. So whatever version it is, that's what determines his phenotype. He is white-eyed, this parent, because the only allele he has for eye color is the W version, the white version. Okay, so that's the parental generation. If they're going to be crossed, they first each have to individually make gametes via meiosis, right? But she's a true breeder, so it doesn't matter which of these two red carrying X chromosomes is chosen by meiosis. They're the same. And that's why this Punnett square does not have two rows like other ones have had. You could do it with two rows, but the second row would be identical to the first, since she can make only one kind of egg. It's just shorthand this way. He, on the other hand, can make two different kinds of sperm. one that chooses the X chromosome and one that chooses the Y chromosome. By the way, when we have a sex-linked characteristic like we do here, then the Punnett square not only tells you the genotypes of the offspring, it also tells you the sex of the offspring. All right? So if you get this egg, the only kind of egg that's possible from this true breeding parent, together with this sperm that's an X chromosome, then you're going to make an XX individual. So this box represents the half of the offspring that will be females. And what this tells you is that 100% of the F1 females should be heterozygous, and therefore, because of complete dominance, they should be red-eyed. The right half of the Punnett square in the F1 says that 100% of the males, an X and a Y, should be red-eyed. Okay? Well, that's exactly what we got. They were all red-eyed, the F1s. But for a slightly different reason compared to all of the flowers being purple. That was an autosomal case. There was no difference between males and females. Here there is a difference. All of the females are heterozygous. All of the males are hemizygous. Okay, then we get the F1s together to produce the F2. So we're crossing this F1 female with this F1 male. Well, once again, they have to make gametes, and this female, though, unlike the parent that was the female parent, the P generation, she is heterozygous. So she can make two different kinds of eggs. You can choose this X chromosome or this X chromosome, and therefore both eggs are listed on the left. It's going to have two rows in it, Punnett square. He can make two kinds of sperm, of course, an X or a Y. And now when you get these gametes together, it matters which one is chosen. But this Punnett square tells you that on the left, the first column, which represents all of the females, half of the females should be homozygous dominant, half of them should be heterozygous, right? But because of complete dominance, phenotypically they'll be the same. All of the females, in other words, in the F2 should be red-eyed. Well, they are. The reason they list two of them here is because half of the females are homozygous and half of them are heterozygous. The same Punnett square tells you that in the F2, half of the males should be red-eyed, half should be white-eyed. It just depends on which egg is chosen, because the egg for a male is the only source of an X chromosome. A male is XY. It has to have gotten its Y from its father because its mother is XX. So the X that a male has comes from its mother. She was heterozygous, so she can give him either the white allele or the red allele. That's going to make half of the males white-eyed, half of them red-eyed. So it's not the same thing as the 3-to-1 ratio because sex does matter. All of the females are red-eyed, half of the males are red-eyed, half are white-eyed. Anything that's not clear about that sex-linked example? All right. Well, let's look at this X and Y chromosomes. This is from a human, slide 4. You can see how drastically bigger the X chromosome is compared to the Y. So any of the thousands of genes that are on this part near the telomeres, that position just doesn't exist on the Y chromosome. So whenever you're talking about any one of these genes for which there's only one allele in a male, that's a sex-linked gene and will operate a little bit differently. Slide 5. Well, this shows you just a few examples of sex determination mechanisms. This is only for animals, just what the publisher decided to use. And this is by no means an exhaustive list of even animals, but of course there's plenty of non-animals that are sexual as well, sexual species. They have sex determination mechanisms as well. Anyway, this just shows you some of the variety, including humans at the top, but actually what's true for humans is true for all mammals. We use the XY system, which is what we've just been talking about. Look at the genotypes, though. Why is the male listed as 44 plus XY? What's the 44 all about? Exactly. Humans have autosomes and sex chromosomes. Human adults are diploid, right? Animals are diploid, or mammals in general are diploid as adults. So there are 22 autosome types, but a diploid has two of each of them, so that's 44 of the overall 46 chromosomes. And then you have two sex chromosomes. Well, if your two sex chromosomes are one X and one Y, then that makes you genetically a male. Female, on the other hand, is 44 plus XX. So those are the diploid versions. They make gametes that are, of course, haploid. So notice that it's 22 plus either an X or a Y. Also notice, though, that since a female is XX, then with respect to sex determination, determining the sex of the offspring, the only thing, only kind of chromosome she can pass on is an X, since that's all she has. She therefore does not determine the sex of the offspring. She gives one X, and then the male gives either a second X or a Y to determine whether it's a female or a male, respectively. So in the XY system that humans are examples of, it's the father that determines the sex of the offspring. Well, next below that is the so-called X0 system. You can call it XO, but it's actually a zero, meaning standing for nothing. And in this system, like for grasshoppers, how many kinds of chromosomes are in grasshoppers? In other words, what is the N? What's the N for humans? 23 for humans. So look at the 44 plus XY. You see how that makes sense with 23? Okay, what's the N for grasshoppers? 12. 11 autosomes and a sex chromosome. Okay? But notice these differences here. There's not, unlike us, in which there are two versions of the one sex chromosome, there's an X version and a Y version, not so in grasshoppers. They have a sex chromosome, which is different from all the autosomes, but what determines the sex is not the types of sex chromosomes, it's how many sex chromosomes the individual has. So a female has 11 pairs of autosomes plus two X chromosomes, which is the only kind of sex chromosome in this species. A male will also have 11 pairs of autosomes, but only one X chromosome. And that makes him male. Now, the ZW system, which birds exhibit or exemplify, is more or less exactly the opposite of our XY system. It works exactly the same way. What's opposite about it is that the male in the XY system is the one that has both of the two different kinds of sex chromosomes, but in birds it's the female that has one of each, and the male has two of the same. The other difference, of course, is that our chromosomes are called X and Y. In the ZW system, there's the Z chromosome and the W chromosome. But notice that the female bird is a ZW. The male, on the other hand, has two Zs. Just the opposite of how it is for us. And therefore, just the opposite occurs with respect to which parent determines the sex of the offspring. It's the male of XY that determines the sex of the offspring. It's the female bird in the ZW system that determines the sex of the offspring, because she can make an egg that's either Z or W, whereas he can make only Z sperm. All right, and then the final one is the one that's kind of bizarre from our point of view for various reasons. It's the so-called haplodiploid system. And this, you find this in social insects like bees that form colonies and work together. In the haplodiploid system, there are no sex chromosomes. There are only autosomes. And then for this species of bees, there are 16, notice. Well, what determines the sex, since there aren't any sex chromosomes, is the ploidy. So there are 16 types of chromosomes in this bee species. If an individual has two of each of those 16 types, in other words, if that individual is diploid, then that makes that individual female. On the other hand, if there's only one of each of the 16 types, then that makes the individual male. Haploids are male. All right, so a male has only half as the total number of chromosomes that a female has. Now, what makes this kind of bizarre from our point of view is that, well, another thing that's weird about this, that's unusual for animals in general, is that a female bee, of course, can produce eggs. That's not what's unusual. Females in general produce eggs. But what's unusual about bees is that she does not have to have an egg be fertilized for it to grow up into an adult bee. You know, if your eggs go unfertilized, they just die as eggs that get too old. They're only going to remain alive if a sperm comes along and fertilizes them, after which they're no longer an egg, right? They're a zygote at that point. A bee, on the other hand, can lay eggs without mating, and those eggs can develop into bees without any father involved. Well, think about what's happening here. This female, by definition, in the haplodiploid system, she is diploid. That's what makes her female. But when she lays her eggs, those are produced by meiosis, just like in us. So the eggs that are produced by that diploid female are haploid, right? Meiosis reduces the ploidy. That means that all of her eggs are male. And when they develop into multicellular bees, all of her offspring will be sons. Because they'll all be diploid. They'll all be haploid. On the other hand, she can choose to mate, in which case all her eggs will be fertilized and therefore be diploid. Or the zygotes that the eggs turn into will be diploid, which means they'll develop into females. So she can mate and have daughters, or she can not mate and have sons, which is a little bit different from how we do things. A little bit more of weirdness, though, is that that means that a male bee has no father and can have no son. Right? Because if a male had a father, that means a male and a female produced him. Well, that's impossible. The only way for a male bee to exist is if he's haploid, which can only happen if the eggs go unfertilized, which means no father was involved. And the reason a bee cannot have a son is that if he mates, his sperm is going to fertilize an egg to produce a diploid offspring, which is by definition a female. He can have only daughters. But even though he doesn't have a father and he can't have a son, He does have a grandfather, and he can have grandchildren. Right? He has a grandfather because his mother was produced by two getting together. His grandmother and his grandfather. But then he only had a mother, not a mother and a father. And he can produce a grandson, because if he mates, he can make a mother, which can then not mate and produce sons of her own, which would be his grandsons. So it's weird to us, but that works well for them. Okay, now to 6. These Punnett squares just represent some of the possibilities, not all of them, but some of the possibilities when we're dealing with heritable genetic disorders. A genetic disorder is anything involving genes. So like I said before, when we talk about cancer is a genetic disorder, but it's not a heritable genetic disorder. Cancer happens because of damage to your genes during your lifetime, not because of what genes you get from your parents. But a heritable genetic disorder is something that you have because of the genes that you got from your parents. And in most cases, a genetic disorder is caused by a recessive allele, meaning that the dominant version is the wild type version that does not give you the disorder. In this scheme of symbols, a blank box in a Punnett square or in a parent refers to an individual that is completely normal, does not have the disorder, but also doesn't even have any of the mutant alleles. Completely unaffected, in other words. A dark red means that individual has the disorder. And a light red means that that individual is a carrier. A carrier of a heritable genetic disorder is a heterozygous individual. It has one normal allele and one mutant form that can cause the disorder, but the carrier does not have the disorder because being heterozygous has one normal allele that's enough to keep them from having the disorder. But they're called carriers because that carrier can pass on the mutant allele that can cause the disorder in an offspring. It just depends on the other parent as to the probability of that happening. And that's what these three examples show. So on the left, you have a completely normal, in other words, homozygous wild type mother, and an affected male. The father has the disorder. If they mate, then the Punnett square says that 100% of the daughters, which is the left column, will be carriers. None of the daughters will have the disorder, but they'll all be carriers. However many sons they have, though, will be completely normal. And that's because every male offspring has to have gotten its X from its mother, and she was totally normal. It's a little bit more chancy if you have a carrier mother and an unaffected father. In this case, none of the females will have the disorder, but half of them will be carriers, half of them will be normal. On the other hand, half of the boys will be affected by the disorder and half of them will be totally normal. And then if you cross a carrier mother with an affected father, then it's, of course, even more chancy, because in that case, half of the children overall will be affected. Half of the females will be affected, half will be carriers. Half of the males will be affected, half will be normal. The only way to get totally normal individual will be to have a son and to get lucky and get the normal version of the allele. But anyway, these Punnett squares are what you can do with genetic testing to determine whether you might or might not want to have children, depending on your own genotypes. All right, slide 7. This slide brings up the notion of dosage, gene dosage. And this only comes into play when we're talking about sex-linked chromosome, or sex-linked genes. As we've already described earlier today, a sex-linked gene is a gene that's on a sex chromosome. Well, cats are fellow mammals, so they use the XY system just like we do. And just like in us, the X is bigger than the Y, so there are genes that are on the X chromosome that are not on the Y chromosome. This is where the word dosage comes in. If you're talking about one of these sex-linked genes, then that means the male has only half of the dose of alleles compared to a female. Right? She has two alleles, since she has two X chromosomes. He has only one, since he has only one X chromosome. So that's a difference in dosage. Natural selection has caused there to evolve mechanisms of so-called dosage compensation. Dosage compensation is somehow getting the two sexes more or less equal. And this happens different ways depending on the species. One possibility, when you think about the inequity, males having only half as many alleles as females, you could accomplish dosage compensation by bringing the male somehow up to the level of the female. Well, what do genes do? They get transcribed, right? So if you have a gene in a male that is twice as easy to transcribe and therefore will be transcribed twice as often, then you end up making the same amount of mRNA as a female makes with two alleles. Right? So that would be bringing the male up to the level of the female, which some species do. The other major way, though, is to bring the female down to the level of the male. And that's what mammals, including cats, do. That is done by a specific mechanism called X chromosome inactivation. So remember that the X chromosome is the bigger one, right? It's the one that has the allele on it, the Y doesn't. A female, by definition, in the XY system is XX. So she's the one that has two alleles. X chromosome inactivation refers to inactivating one of those two X chromosomes that a female has in each cell. Keep in mind that every cell has the same set of chromosomes within an individual. All right. So this X chromosome inactivation occurs only in females. You wouldn't want to inactivate an X chromosome in a male because he only has one X chromosome. That would kill him. He wouldn't be able to use any of the genes that are on the X chromosome. Well, how do you inactivate an X chromosome? We talked earlier, for different reasons, about chromatin and the fact that for most of the cell cycle, the chromatin has to be loose so that you can access the code that's in genes so they can be transcribed. Right? You only coil it up, condense it, when you're getting ready to separate so it doesn't become a tangled mess. Well, the way you inactivate an X chromosome is to make it even more condensed than it is normally during cell division. You make it so condensed that none of those genes can be used. And so the X chromosome, that second X chromosome still exists in the cell. It just is not going to be able to be used for anything. And therefore, that female cell, in effect, has only one active X chromosome, and that brings that cell down to the level of the male cell. All right, any problems with any of that so far? Now, a cat, which is this example, starts out as a zygote, of course, right? One diploid cell, a zygote. which then undergoes mitosis to become multicellular. That's when we call it an embryo. And early on, that embryo is however many cells big, but it doesn't really have any cat-like form yet. It's just a ball of cells. It'll eventually develop into a fetus that looks more and more cat-like until it's eventually born. But the reason I'm mentioning this is that X chromosome inactivation does not occur when it's a zygote, when it's one cell. If it did occur as a zygote, you wouldn't have what's happening here happen. Instead, X chromosome inactivation occurs in the early embryonic stage, where there are already a bunch of cells, not nearly as many as there will be in the body of the kitten, but there's already multiple cells. And each one independently flips a coin as to which of the two X chromosomes is going to be inactivated in that cell. Okay, each cell has two X chromosomes in a female, right? One of them is going to be turned off permanently for the lifetime of that cat. One of them is going to stay on. Well, if you have a homozygous cat, and by the way, this example deals with fur color. There's two different possible alleles, orange fur and black fur. Right? If you have a homozygous cat, it doesn't matter whether it's homozygous dominant or homozygous recessive, because you, in both of those cases, you have two of the same allele, and therefore it doesn't matter which one gets inactivated. Okay? And so this individual is not homozygous that we see pictured here. It's a patchwork of orange hair and black hair with no pattern. That happens because when this cat was an embryo, it's a mass of cells, each cell flips its own coin and turns either black off and produces eventually orange fur, or turns orange off and produces black fur. But that inactivation occurs only one time, once there's already multiple cells, but then once it happens, that cell is going to produce many cells by splitting. But all of those cells that spring from that one cell originally will have the same one turned off. And therefore, it depends on where the cell is in this mass making up the embryo as to which body region is orange or black on the adult. The yellow furry regions are the descendants of cells that in the embryo turned the black one off randomly. And the black ones turned the orange one off. And then, so they correspond to regions in the adult, depending on where they are in the embryo. If that happened as a zygote, all of them would have the same one turned off. And therefore, the cat would be either black fully or orange fully. Instead, it's a random patchwork of the two, and we call such an individual, which has to be a heterozygote for that to happen, we call that individual a mosaic. It has to be a female, and it has to be heterozygous. Do you understand why for both of those? It doesn't happen in males. They don't inactivate X's. It doesn't happen in homozygous females because the way the coin flip ends up does not matter. But it does matter in heterozygous females. So she's a mosaic, and it's pretty obvious just by looking at her. Well, human females have a similar possibility, but not with color, not with anything that you can just look at from afar and tell. It has to do with the ability to freely sweat. So heterozygous females will have, if you get in there and really look at it microscopically, parts of her skin that are able to freely sweat and parts that aren't. Which is, she's a mosaic as well, but you just can't tell by looking at her because it's not fur color. That's as far as I wanted to get today, so let's stop a little early.